for a blind and print-impaired audience. The North Carolina Reading Service brings you the Indie Week Journal. I'm John Federson, your reader for this issue, dated October 21st, 2020. And thanks for our theme music today. Goes to a name familiar to some old computing fans. That's Deep Blue, the old supercomputer, which had lost several recent chess matches and been repurposed to playing musical selections for elevators, restaurants, and lucky broadcasts like this one. And a big thanks to Deep Blue. And our voices column, the first one I'll read today, Making History, is written by Courtney Napier. Why the Wake County Board of Election, why the Board of Education election is so important. There are a plethora of events in Wake County I could write about this week. The ramming through of the downtown south development despite affected property that consistently sees flooding. Indy Week's vapid and condescending endorsement of Raleigh's affordable, for the middle class when displacing the underclass, housing bond. And a poll worker's recent assault by a Republican poll observer and the calamitous response of the Wake County GOP. But, in my mind, the most pressing issue involves the Wake County Board of Education election. If you have moved to Wake County in the last 10 years, which data suggests a whole lot of you have, then you may not have the full story of why this race is so important. There are currently five conservative candidates looking to become the new majority on the WCBOE. While only three of the seven challengers have experience in the education sector, those that don't have some fascinating resumes. Rachel Mill, who's running against Chris Hagerty for District 7, encompassing West Raleigh and Morrisville, was the press secretary for Libertarian Senator Ron Paul for 4 years before becoming a real estate agent. On her campaign Facebook page, there's a photo of her wearing a Trump 2020 T-shirt. Steve Bergstrom and Gregory Hahn running against Lindsay Mahaffrey for Southern Wakes District 8 and Monica Johnson-Holzer for Southeast Wakes District 2, respectively, are both military veterans who are enthusiastic about the Wake County Public School System's controversial School Resource Officer Program. Hahn has been especially supportive of police in schools, receiving an endorsement from the Fraternal Order of Police, Wake County Lodge No. 41. The SRO program has been under fire since its inception for instances of excessive force against students, from a child being pepper-sprayed while restrained in 2008 to a young girl being body-slammed in 2017, which was caught on video and went viral. There are also egregious disparities in how black and white students are disciplined. WCPSS was under investigation by the U.S. Department of Education for almost a decade after the NAACP and Southern Coalition of Social Justice filed a complaint. Karen Carter, challenging Bill Fletcher of Cary and Apex District 9, and Deborah Pickett, running against Heather Scott for Eastern Wakes District 1, both have experience in education, but their platforms are vague, and their true intentions can only be known by their past decisions in leadership. While Carter doesn't have a record to pull from, Prickett was one of the architects for the school assignment plan that destroyed Wake County's celebrated diversity policy. She and the rest of the conservative challengers in 2009 Board of Elections race were all backed by Art Pope, the right-wing megadonor and current chair of the UNC Board of Governors. Prickett says she believes all children should have access to good schools, but she is not committed to reinstating a diversity policy for school reassignment plans. She and her fellow challengers are also reticent about increasing the public school budget, even though the ruling from the landmark Leandro case deemed a budget increase essential to creating equity in school achievement. Part of the reason Wake County's population grew by 43.5% from 2000 to 2010 is that we had schools that were diverse, accomplished, and staffed by enthusiastic and well-resourced teachers. In 2009, through the efforts of conservative multimillionaires and opportunistic community members, that legacy was trashed. Now another group of conservative challengers are seeking to do it again. Nearly every GOP candidate praises alternatives to traditional public schools like charters, private schools, and even homeschooling. But in Wake County, school board members don't have jurisdiction over these schools. Why spend time talking about something you cannot contribute to through your role as a board member? As in 2009, these individuals claim to want to give a voice to Wake County parents, but many parents are left out. When Hahn referred to the Education Justice Alliance as an outside group in a recent article, he neglected to say that the EJA is comprised almost entirely of parents and caregivers of WCPSS students. These new challengers do not seek the well-being of all our students when over half the school population are students of color. And there is a unified call to shut down the Public School Office of Equity Affairs. Bergstrom is especially vocal in his disdain for school lessons that include Black Lives Matter or the 1619 Project, echoing Trump's sentiments in referring to them as politically motivated lessons, and saying that school boards should take a strong stand against activism in the classroom. The lack of integrity in our history classes plays a major role in the racial strife we see today. Who would we be as a nation if we learned that George Washington's dentures were not made of wood, but teeth pulled from the mouths of the living people he owned as property? Or that the FBI sent letters to Martin Luther King Jr.'s home urging him to commit suicide? Understanding these truths might have allowed us to change the inequities that still cost our country trillions of dollars and countless lives. It has taken us 10 years to begin rebuilding what the conservative board from 2009 destroyed. We must not move backward again. And their 15 Minutes column features the pigeon racing fourth graders of Central Park School. Durham's Central Park School in January hatched and began raising homing pigeons. This week, the next year of fourth graders met the birds. They'll now take over the training in the hopes of competing in North Carolina Combine's spring pigeon races. Teacher Aaron Siebens let the Indy ask the class a few questions over Zoom. "What were your first impressions of the pigeons?" Malcolm: "When I got to hold one of them, it was really soft. It looked up to me like, who's holding me? Let me go." And Ollie answered, "When I was holding one of them, something I didn't know pigeons could do was turn its head all the way around to face me. It turned its head all the way around and was looking straight at me." "Spooky. How many pigeons are there?" "There's six pigeons. Aaron, can I tell her the story? Okay, so 2 days ago, one of the pigeons got attacked by a hawk, and there's a bunch of feathers around the loft. Ryder was attacked by a hawk, but he's okay." Aaron says, "We didn't know till this year, but September and October is a big hawk season. There's more around because they're migrating through." "How do these birds know how to find their way home?" Ollie says, "They have a little thing on their nose called a wattle. Some other birds have them, I think chickens. And nobody knows exactly how they know where home is, but when they spend a bunch of time in one area, or maybe when they know where their food is, they know, like, that's where I want to go." Aaron says, "They're very food-driven, yeah. Does anyone know what's in their wattle so they can find their way home?" And Alexander says, "They can sense magnetic fields all over the earth." "Does anyone have any favorite facts they want to share?" Lucille: "Pigeons can fly 60 miles an hour. Eloise: "In the pigeon racing book that we read, it said people have been using for pigeons for almost 3,000 years. And Mr. Siebens says, "We're going to start racing them in February. If our flock is big enough, we're going to do the North Carolina races, which is the big game. We're going to try and get them trained up this fall so they're ready for the spring races." Our column, which is labeled op-ed each week, this week is called Washed Out, and it's written by Lucia Constantine. At a time when people need to wash their hands to stop the spread of the coronavirus, the city of Durham is shutting off their water. In mid-September, the city announced it would resume shutoffs for non-payment, even though the pandemic is still raging and the economic fallout deeply felt. In doing so, the city threatens public health and creates yet another burden for households that are already struggling to make ends meet. Almost 5,000 water accounts in Durham were eligible for disconnection at the end of July, according to data submitted to the Utilities Commission. Before then, residents were protected by a March executive order from Governor Cooper banning water, sewer, and electricity shutoffs. That moratorium on disconnections ended in July, along with federal unemployment benefits. Without the moratorium, the safety and health of our residents are threatened as unemployment remains high and coronavirus cases are expected to grow through the fall and winter. Washing hands is one of the most critical preventative measures against the spread of the coronavirus. Without water, our residents cannot engage in even the most basic tasks of sanitation and survival. Shutting off water not only impacts individual households, it compromises the health of our entire community, especially our most vulnerable residents. Communities that are most vulnerable to COVID-19 are the same communities vulnerable to water shutoffs. In Durham County, Black and Latinx residents have been disproportionately impacted by the coronavirus, making up over 75% of confirmed cases. Black and Latinx residents are also more likely to have lost their jobs during the pandemic, to face housing cost burden and instability, and to have little or no savings for weathering an economic shock. The pandemic has exposed and exacerbated the systemic failures and inequities in our neighborhoods, economy, and public infrastructure that were created by structural racism and decades of disinvestment. Shutting off water is a punitive measure that increases the burdens residents already face and puts them at greater risk for contracting the virus along with our entire community. Water shutoffs preceded the pandemic, of course. Between June 2016 and June 2019, there were more than 30,000 disconnections, about 12,000 a year, in Durham, concentrated near the center of the city and east of downtown, according to a report from the National League of Cities presented at a recent Durham City Council work session. People living in low-income areas or communities of color were more likely to experience shutoffs. Residents that had their water shut off reported feelings of diminishment, failure, and shame, along with increased levels of stress, anxiety, and hardship. They had to pawn their belongings, forego bathing, or send their kids to school wearing the same clothes until they were able to pay. During that same period, the city collected $2.1 million in disconnection and late fees. To its credit, the city's Department of Water Management has a program to help residents pay past due water bills, but it is consistently underutilized. $170,000 went unused in the past 3 years. That wouldn't cover what residents currently owe, which is closer to $1 million, but it would help some families who are already behind. The amount residents currently owe represents only 1% of the total projected revenue for water and sewer services. According to the latest financial report to the city manager, operating revenues for water and sewer services currently exceed the budget, and the fund has, quote, consistently finished each fiscal year in a strong financial position. Even if Durham were to lose 20% of its water and sewer revenue, or $20 million due to the COVID-19, one estimate shows it would still be able to cover operations, maintenance, and debt service costs for more than 8 years by using its unrestricted cash to offset losses. In addition to offering payment plans and expanding the reach of its underutilized hardship fund, the City of Durham should eliminate disconnection fees and suspend shutoffs for non-payment. Doing so is not only a compassionate response to an unprecedented emergency, but also a necessary public health measure during a pandemic. Beyond these measures, Durham has an opportunity to reimagine how we might provide clean water to everyone, regardless of economic status. Access to safe and clean water shouldn't be a commodity, especially during a pandemic and economic recession. Now, news from Raleigh, and this column by Katie Jane Fernelius. Instagram accountability. Just a day after appointing James Carr McClam, Jr. to the North Carolina State Board of Elections earlier this month, Governor Roy Cooper rescinded the nominations amid allegations of abuse from McClam's ex-girlfriend. Speaking with the News and Observer, the woman said she had called the governor's office the week before to quietly disclose her story but didn't get a reply. So she decided to publish her experiences on an Instagram account aiming to provide a safe space for the survivors of abuse, the NC Protection Alliance. All summer, the alliance had been sharing stories of misconduct in the restaurant, bar, and tattoo industries in Raleigh. These stories, which often named the men they accused, had prompted several businesses to fire employees, issue apologies, and in some cases, choose to close. When Governor Cooper rescinded McClam's appointment, it became clear that a social media account that had begun as an informal avenue for women to share their experiences of sexual harassment in the Raleigh service industry had, in a few short months, expanded into something much bigger. The alliance wasn't just making an impact in North Carolina's bar and restaurant scene, it was shaping its politics, too. The NC Protection Alliance started as a way to publicize a story that its founder, Wendy, kept hearing. Wendy and other members of the alliance requested we use their first names only due to the repeated harassment the account has received. 2 years ago, a close friend told Wendy that a man from her work had raped her. This man was a staple in the downtown Raleigh service industry scene. He frequently hung out at King's, the music venue upstairs from Garland, the restaurant where he was employed at the time, and floated through popular late-night dive bars like Ruby Deluxe. Wendy had heard rumors about the man, but most of them were vague and suggested what felt already evident. He was a little creepy and desperate. She avoided him on the advice of an ex-boyfriend and warned friends to do the same. Then, this summer, another friend told her that the man had raped her. Wendy realized in that moment that what had allegedly happened to her two friends could have happened to other women, too. Simply whispering warnings to each other was not an adequate way to handle the threat this man posed, so she decided to put out a call on her Instagram story. If anyone has a story about Adam Atashi, I'll post it on my stories and cut out your name. Nearly 20 women replied with their own experiences, according to Wendy. 5 times as many reached out with stories about other local men. Atashi, who no longer works at Garland, was not able to be reached for comment. Garland owner Chidi Kumar said she was unaware of any allegations against Atashi at that time and regrets she ever employed him. Wendy says all of these stories were about a very specific network of people in central downtown Raleigh. She noted that celebrity restaurateurs and bartenders were coming under fire after years of accolades. The pandemic made it possible, in some ways, for people to begin speaking out. This summer, many service industry employees found themselves out of work as public health restrictions prompted bars and restaurants to close down. Amid this forced industry hibernation, conversations that had been bubbling beneath the surface for years boiled over on social media. Allegations of racism had recently come out against the owners of Bidamanda and Brewery Bavana, followed by allegations of sexual harassment and assault against their bar manager, Jordan Hester. These conversations weren't just happening in Raleigh. Local service industry stakeholders were reckoning with similar allegations in Greensboro, too. Wendy was in touch with a woman there, and they discussed the need for these conversations to go beyond their own social circles and find a more communal digital place to live. So they created Instagram pages for their respective cities that shared the same name, NC Safety Alliance. Other cities across North Carolina soon followed their lead, Charlotte, Asheville, and Durham, among others, and began publicizing stories about known abusers and harassers in their town. So far, though, arguably none of those pages had made a bigger impact than the Raleigh chapter. Absent other avenues for accountability, social media has become a popular platform for survivors looking to share their stories of sexual harassment and assault. In 2017, women posted about their own experiences on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the hashtag MeToo. This year in Egypt, a woman's anonymous Instagram post detailing accusations against a rich and influential young man on her university campus ballooned into what some are calling the country's own MeToo moment. In 2015, social media fervor surrounding the story of a woman in Turkey who was killed after trying to stop a man from raping her escalated into street protests. Survivors of sexual assault, largely women, can find support on these platforms that can be difficult to locate otherwise. Filing a police report or testifying in court can put a woman in a position where their experience is interrogated, potentially re-traumatizing them. Even outside the criminal justice system, the social cost of accusing someone of sexual harassment or assault can be huge, especially in a tight-knit scene where the lines between work and social life are blurred. Janelle, another member of the Protection Alliance, dated someone who she says was popular in the downtown Raleigh scene. She says, after they broke up, she told some mutual friends that he had assaulted her, but they didn't believe her. After she decided to post her story, multiple women responded with stories of their own. Janelle says, when other women came forward and said they had had the same experience with him, it was so validating. Obviously, you never want anyone to go through what you went through, but I felt like what had happened to me was real. After that experience, Janelle asked to join the Protection Alliance team, and she's been working with them ever since. The Alliance has created a Google form for survivors who want to submit their stories. The form asks them to share their experience and preferences regarding its publication, such as whether they want comments to be disabled on the post. At the end, whoever is submitting the story checks a box to certify that what they have shared is true to the best of their knowledge. Lauren, who helps Wendy and Janelle run the account, says, we have a process for accepting stories, and we have a process for following up on stories. It's a multi-tiered process where Wendy will read it, then another person will read it. If there's any sort of question or if it doesn't make sense, then we'll get in touch with the survivor to follow up. Typical posts from the Raleigh account include trigger and content warnings, then slides with text from the survivor's story. Each post is captioned with the name of the accused, if provided. If comments are turned on for the post, the Alliance actively moderates them. Early on, every page developed its own style for sharing these stories. The Greensboro account preferred to tag the accused harassers and assaulters, as well as people close to them. They included photos of the accused, too. In contrast, the posts by the Raleigh chapter functioned less like pillories for public humiliation and more like curated conversations. People comment and offer support for survivors, share their own experiences, and sometimes ask questions. Lauren says, we are trying to be very careful about protecting survivors and making sure each post is free from harassment and bullying. But the Alliance has also come up against its fair share of obstacles. It has been hard to keep a consistent group of individuals working to moderate the account. Submissions can be difficult to read, and the comments they receive can be dismissive, abusive, and mean. For instance, in September, the Raleigh account posted a story about a popular tattoo artist. Wendy estimates they got about 7,000 new followers after that post, but they also got a huge influx of harassment. Janelle says, lots of trolls and other people tell us we are trying to destroy people's lives. What we want them to understand is that we're not. We're helping survivors. Whatever happens, because those stories come out, happens. But we're just focusing on the survivors. Even if they work to moderate comments, they still receive hundreds of direct mails, many of them harassing the account from burner accounts. Men and women who know the accused often write them to complain, but they also receive criticism from people with no connection to the stories. Lauren says, I love answering criticisms. 10% are genuine, while 90% are trolls. But even with the trolls, I can recognize real criticisms with their responses. Sometimes in answering them, there can be a productive conversation. After receiving a cease and desist letter from one of the men who was accused, Wendy and other members of the Alliance met with a lawyer who advised them to start an LLC to protect themselves from legal liability. By forming an LLC, they would also be able to collect and distribute money to survivors to connect them with resources like legal representation, crisis counseling, long-term mental health care, or mediation. They asked the chapters in other cities if they were interested, and all but two, Greensboro and Winston-Salem, said yes. Now an LLC, the group would henceforth be known as the NC Protection Alliance. Soon after, a mock account appeared on Instagram with the same logo and a similar handle. It claimed to be trying to hold the Raleigh chapter accountable and posted accusations against the owner of a local bakery who, the mock account alleged, had provided free bread for a Raleigh chapter event. The account was quickly shut down. Lauren says, what was so refreshing for me to see was when we were feeling overwhelmed and responding to all this, the community started to respond in support of us. We really trust the community, and a lot of people really validated our work and how we were doing it. When the story came in for a survivor who alleged that the newly appointed McLam had abused her, Wendy was initially nervous, but Lauren reassured her this was no different than other stories they received. So they decided to publish. In the post, the ex-girlfriend says that McLam pressured her into sex, filmed their encounters without her consent, and once held her against a wall and screamed at her. The next day, Governor Cooper rescinded that appointment. This is why I started this, Wendy says, for a real change to happen. Inspirational stories about women sharing their experiences of sexual assault often stop with the act of sharing, as though the sharing itself were a bow that ties the story together and resolves the trauma. While speaking out does not provide automatic closure, the story of the Protection Alliance does show that it can provide opportunities for healing, justice, and ultimately deep community. Wendy says, we're still limited to North Carolina and Raleigh, which makes this feel like a real community conversation. This stuff used to only be discussed in small conversations between two, three people, close friends. Now we're talking about it openly. A cover story from Indie Week issue of October 21, The Lost Cause. That is written by Charlie McGee. In March 2019, Bill Starnes emailed his neo-Confederate colleagues to discuss what he saw as a need for more political influence in their movement. He said, thanks to law enforcement, it's not likely our current struggle will require the use of weapons to any high degree, wrote Starnes, a lead officer and de facto enforcer for the North Carolina Division of Sons of Confederate Veterans, Incorporated. Instead, Starnes urged his membership to take steps toward greater political involvement, including one they could take immediately. Give more money to the NC Heritage PAC, a pro-Republican fundraising outfit that he and other NCSCV leaders had been running for years. We have men there, he wrote. We can immediately provide them with funds to get the right folks in office. Less than a year after Starnes sent that email, the State Board of Elections opened an investigation into the Political Action Committee, a coup-minded crusade of current and former SCV members exposed the operation from within, intensifying a schism in the group that has taken an increasingly public face ever since. Now, Board of Elections investigator Matthew Martucci has what one neo-Confederate describes as a thick-ass file in an ongoing investigation that's scrutinizing the NCSCV for running the Heritage PAC in violation of its own tax-exempt status and funding it through a separate illegal scheme for years, according to multiple people familiar with the matter, including the PAC's co-treasurer and a dissenting SCV member who is assisting the investigation. Martucci declined to comment. Since its inception in early 2016, the Heritage PAC has allowed the neo-Confederate group to raise money from its underlings, shuffle it to supportive Republicans under a different name, and avoid paying taxes on the effort by exploiting nonprofit law. The Heritage PAC has given at least $28,500 to various Republican campaigns committees since it launched, including $3,500 to Agriculture Commissioner Steve Troxler, who has for years ensured a booth for the NCSCV at the Raleigh State Fair, and $2,500 to both House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger. Experts who've analyzed reporting gathered by the Indy, including a former North Carolina Assistant Attorney General, say some NCSCV officers appeared to have committed multiple misdemeanors and at least one felony in their PAC activities. Those charges could be recommended by Martucci's investigation, though additional approval within the Board of Elections is required for indictments. On July 22nd, the Heritage PAC went inactive, not dead, just dormant. It hasn't made any campaign contributions in 2020, despite this being a major election year in local and state races. But it incurred one expense of note, $5,000 in attorney fees, paid on February 18th to Brian Lavecchi, a litigation attorney with Comalander Adcock LLP. Lavecchi couldn't be reached for comment. The Neo-Confederates group's leaders received the certification to run Heritage PAC from the Board of Elections in February 2016. Their initial filing before that certification described the PAC's political purpose as, quote, supporting candidates who support North Carolina's heritage, and named the NCSCV as its connected organization. But that's a fundamental problem. The NCSCV has always been forbidden for running a PAC. That's because, for more than a decade, the neo-Confederate group has enjoyed a 501c3 status with the U.S. Internal Revenue Service. Broadly speaking, the IRS grants this status to organizations that exist only for, quote, charitable purposes. The perks include not having to pay federal, local, or property taxes, but for these privileges, these 501c3cs are, amongst other things, quote, absolutely prohibited from directly or indirectly participating in political campaigns, according to the IRS website. The Board of Elections flirted with this issue in an early audit of more than $1,700 the PAC took from the NCSCV, but it later greenlit the money after the SCV sent a letter saying the contributions complied with state law. This green light was incorrect, say experts who've assessed the case, including John Wallace, former Assistant Attorney General in the NC Department of Justice Antitrust Division. Quote, Wallace says, what was omitted from all of that discussion and what is absolutely inherent in the proper resolution of the issue is that if you are a 501c3, you are absolutely prohibited from intervening in political campaigns. The Heritage PAC took a new funding approach that dodged any mention of the NCSCV in its future disclosures, gathering mass donations from within the statewide SCV chapter, getting hundreds of mostly unwitting members to claim slices of the money, and pumping each slice into the Heritage PAC as an individual contribution, disconnected from the SCV. The strategy is akin to one faucet pumping a single stream of water, say, into 150 different filters that all lead into the same cup. In this case, the faucet water is the NCSCV's money. The filters are the SCV members laundering the money. And the all-encompassing cup is the Heritage PAC. This kind of tactic has a name in campaign finance circles, contributions in the name of another. Wallace says it's a Class II misdemeanor. He adds, a statement made under oath, such as that made by a treasurer knowing the information to be untrue, is guilty of a Class I felony. In an August 2017 email exchange, three SCV members, taking credit for contributions, asked the Heritage PAC's co-treasurer, Mitchell Flincham, what they were supposed to do with a form that, quote, Bill said I needed to fill out. Flincham, an SCV member in Burlington, offered to share the form in question with them and eventually took one member's information to help finish the process for them. Flincham's role in the scheme here, Wallace says, is, quote, in the nature of perjury, because as a PAC treasurer, he's responsible for honestly reporting financials to the state. The Board of Elections investigation touched off after a January 22nd complaint from veteran campaign finance watchdog Bob Hall, which reaffirmed a prior report by the Daily Tar Heel and called for a comprehensive investigation and appropriate enforcement action. Members facing scrutiny for the investigation brought in an attorney early this year, Fincham told the Indy. He declined to give further specifics. The Martucci-led inquiry won't issue findings until at least after the 2020 general election, according to the new Confederate assisting the investigation. It isn't uncommon for complaints to pile up at the under-resourced Board of Elections. Hall says some complaints he filed years ago are still in the board's investigatory pipeline. Regardless of time frame, the NCSCV member assisting the inquiry says he's helped at least 10 other members share evidence with investigators. Sounds to us they're not doing this for shits and giggles, said Don Angel, a 43-year-old Newton resident who helped catalyze an ongoing power struggle within the North Carolina SCV. Angel is not engaging with the investigation, but he is part of a cadre of former and current members aiming to oust current commander Kevin Stone, a power player in the neo-Confederate world. In addition to leading the state's Sons of Confederate Veterans chapter, Stone is the co-founder and national leader of the Mechanized Cavalry, a motorcycle-riding spin-off of the broader SCV. He also recently took over the national organization's Army of Northern Virginia, which represents SCV members in Virginia, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. In his day job, Stone is a probation officer in Chatham Counties for the North Carolina's Department of Public Safety. His trusted circle includes Carnes and Boyd Cathy, a former state archivist who co-chaired televangelist Pat Robertson's 1988 presidential campaign, and according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, quote, became a key player in the multi-year attempt by racist extremists to assume control of the Sons of Confederate Veterans in the early 2000s. The three men have declined or not responded to requests for comment. Some North Carolina SCV members told IndyWeek they didn't realize that claiming contributions for the Heritage PAC was dubious because it was presented to them as a standard fundraising effort. Member Chadwick Rogers says that on two occasions he was given $200 by Starnes, the NCSCV legislative officer, and was told to give it to Stone as a donation to the Heritage PAC. When I started asking questions about the form they asked me to fill out, Rogers said, he never asked me again. As buzz grew about his bid to become our state's next governor, Dan Forrest received two checks that were either too dirty to keep or that he simply never got the chance to cash. Forrest, who's been North Carolina's lieutenant governor for nearly 8 years, wasn't a stranger to the Sons of Confederate Veterans. At least, he wasn't by October 22nd of 2018, the second time the Heritage PAC reported a $1,500 to his campaign, only to walk it back months later. More than 2 months prior, Forrest stood chatting with a former treasurer of the neo-Confederate organization, Gerald Wilson, on the stage floor of a soon-to-be-energized arena in the coastal plains of southeastern North Carolina. Each man, Forrest spotting a casual jeans blazer combo, Wilson donning a more formal red tie with a double styrofoam cup in hand, firmed an arm behind the other's back and smiled for the photo. Preparations continued around them in the lead-up to a campaign rally for State House Representative Jimmy Dixon, chairman of the House Agriculture Committee. It's uncertain what brought Forrest and Wilson together on the arena floor that night, or if there was this was their first encounter. But nearly 3 years into the NCSCV's leader's pursuit of political influence, a personal connection with Forrest, who has long supported Confederate monuments and opposed what he dubbed communist agitators tearing them down, would prove to be fruitful. It's no surprise they'd already sought to fluff Forrest's campaign coffers. Forrest's campaign, however, either never received the PAC's checks or realized they were too risky to accept. The Heritage PAC disclosures list two 1,500 donations it sent to Forrest in 2018, one in April, then a second in October, but it voided both contributions months after the fact. Andrew Dunn, a spokesperson for Forrest's 2020 campaign, declined a request for an interview with the lieutenant governor on the topic, saying in an email that Forrest, quote, believes our society focuses too much time attention on issues that divide. NCSCV members who formed the PAC also declined to comment or didn't respond to Indy. The checks were small fries relative to Forrest's overall donor haul as he prepared for this year's showdown for governor, but their failure to land are two hiccups in a line of question marks and outright red flags, demonstrated by the Heritage PAC and missed by campaign finance regulators for years. The PAC's disclosures consistently show money coming in from members of the NCSCV and Mechanized Cavalry. Membership statuses have been confirmed through other members. A list of cavalry members in North Carolina and an internal spreadsheet listing nearly 58,000 active and inactive SCV members throughout the world as of some point in 2016. The time frame was estimated in an analysis of the spreadsheet's metadata with Elon University computer science professor and data mining expert Megan Squire and the Southern Poverty Law Center's Howard Graves. The first time the Heritage PAC put its money into play hit close to home. It sent $1,000 in April 2016 to the campaign of then-State House Representative Gary Pendleton, an inactive SCV member at the time. The membership spreadsheet includes Pendleton's name, middle initial, and address, and attributes him to an SCV chapter that covers much of the Triangle region. It lists him as inactive, which often means a member hasn't paid their annual dues. Pendleton told the Indy he has never been a member of SCV and wasn't aware of any Heritage PAC contributions. But multiple neo-Confederates confirmed they know he's been a member. A November 2016 blog post by the Heritage PAC lists Pendleton among its endorsements, referring to him as, quote, a stalwart friend of North Carolina's rich heritage. In a post about 9 months earlier, the PAC thanked Pendleton for leading a charge at the request of the NCSCV to continue flying the Confederate flag atop the state capitol in Raleigh 3 days later. I'm sorry, 3 days a year. Despite the boost from his Confederate brethren, Pendleton lost his 2016 election to now incumbent Democrat Cynthia Paul. Disgruntled SCV members who sparked the Board of Elections investigation also helped thwart a backdoor deal that Stone's Circle struck in November 2019 with the Board of North Carolina Systems Board of Governors. The deal temporarily gave the SCV a $2.5 million trust of university money and Silent Sam. The dissenters believe the Confederate statue belongs atop its original pedestal on UNC's Chapel Hill campus and were offended by their leadership accepting any alternative. Their internal effort to, quote, upset the command structure, as Angel puts it, has been bolstered amid protests in the months since George Floyd's death by police in Minneapolis. Paul Burr, a former SCV camp leader, wrote in a July email, Confederate memorials are coming down all over the state while our so-called leaders surrender them to the radical left. But some who remain loyal to Stone's incumbent team have taken their own action in the name of memorial defense. On the morning of May 31st, Jeffrey Allen Long, a 49-year-old Kernersville resident, got the same email hundreds of others received from their embattled commander. Many of them hadn't heard from Stone in months, his message, sent to NCSCV and mechanized cavalry members with the subject line, "Monuments Under Attack," noted that racial justice protests after the arrestee's death in Minneapolis showed no sign of ending soon. "Our intelligence," Stone ambiguously claimed, "showed domestic terrorist groups, including Antifa and BLM and communist groups, were coordinating unrest with a secret goal to, quote, tear down our memorials." Stone urged his underlings to conduct vigilant memorial patrols and networking with local law enforcement and government bodies. He reminded them to, quote, remain safe and follow the law while completing this mission. Around 10 hours after Stone sent that email, Long, a member of both the SCV and mechanized cavalry, was arrested on two misdemeanor counts and later charged with a felony of inciting a riot for twice shooting one of two guns on his person into the air during a peaceful protest in Salisbury. Long declined to comment. Witnesses say he fired his gun just a short distance from protesters who gathered around the town's FAME Confederate monument. Gamali Black, president of the Salisbury Rowan NAACP, helped coordinate the protest in Salisbury that day. He said he was monitoring the crowd from its periphery around the Confederate monument when Long first approached, about an hour before his arrest. As Black describes it, Long pointed at him and at other bystanders, telling each that he would kill them, until the crowd prompted police to direct Long out of the area. The agitator returned an hour or so later, at which time, Black alleges, Long threw a bottle of water dead into my face. When bystanders tried to push Long out of the area, Black said the rogue NCSCV member moved a short distance away, fired his gun twice, and walked away from the scene. Black said, "I would definitely call him an agitator, if not a terrorist." Salisbury police arrested Long on a street near the Confederate monument's now former standing place at around 7 p.m., according to his arrest report. City officials voted unanimously to move the FAME monument in the name of public safety just weeks later. Separate from Long, other NCSCV members have taken to their own forms of antagonism. Burlington resident James Conrad Smithson, a member of the NCSCV and mechanized cavalry, has used Facebook to share memes about shooting protesters, including a plea, in all caps, that said, "President Trump should issue a shoot-on-site order against BLM and Antifa." In one post, Smithson gleefully linked an article about potential protections for drivers who hit protesters with their cars. "Quit! Don't get hit! Pants up! Don't loot!" he wrote. Smithson received the NCSCV's inaugural Hold the Line Award earlier this year for being, quote, very instrumental in conducting operations in Pittsburgh. He is, separately, a member of the League of the South, a group that the Library of Congress describes as, quote, a Southern nationalist organization whose ultimate goal is a free and independent Southern Republic. The Southern Poverty Law Center has designated it a white nationalist hate group. Flincham, the Heritage PAC co-treasurer, is also a member of the League of the South. He denied the affiliation when recently asked, but has said the opposite in past publications, including a 2012 email now archived on southernheritage411.com saying, "I've been proud to be a member of the League of the South as long as I've been in the SCV." The SCV likely has more than 70 members who are jointly in the League of the South, according to an analysis by the Southern Poverty Law Center's Hate Watch of spreadsheets from sources claiming to be in each group. Cross-referencing them shows 73 individuals who were members of both groups at some time between 2013 and 2016. Some dissenting members describe a recent trend of sketchy guys, as one member put it, joining the mechanized cavalry. Starnes, the former mechanized cavalry leader in North Carolina, may have sparked the SCV splinter with an alleged threat to shoot a member on August 3, 2019, during an annual meeting. Three members who say they witnessed the event and others from hearsay repeat the same account. Starnes stood up as Paul Burr, who was pushed out of the SCV after the incident, was openly criticizing Stone's leadership and began pulling his gun from his holster until bystanders stopped and led him out of the room. One camp leader cited the incident in the resignation email he sent about a year later, saying, quote, "That day I saw our division commander and general of the mechanized cavalry throw all principle out the window." In December, Stearns claimed this account is a lie, created and spread by a small group of members seeking to smear him and the group's leadership. Another internal pressure point, the feeling of being on the, quote, low end of a Ponzi scheme, as Angel describes it. In March, the mechanized cavalry donated $15,000 to a National Confederate Museum that the National SCV has planned on building since 2008 near Columbia, Tennessee. Paul Gramling, the National SCV's former commander-in-chief, asked all members in the U.S. on March 28th to donate at least 20% of their $1,200 federal stimulus check to the museum. "God don't want but 10%, said Smitty Smith, a 16-year-old dissenting member in Newton. "I mean, that's begging." Hundreds of members have paid a one-time $100 fee over the years, separate from their annual NCSCV dues, to join the mechanized cavalry, according to multiple members and an internal roster that names more than 500 active and inactive members of the motorcycle group in North Carolina as of early 2020. They've been told to pay only with cash or check made out directly to Starnes. It appears highly unlikely that the group has reported all of this income in recent year tax filings with the IRS. Starnes said in an April 2019 email to members, "As far as I know, and being number 53 in the MEC cab and number 16 here in NC, I know pretty far back we've never had a bank account. We tend to have the cigar box in the gun safe approach." Smith says over the last month, Stone's leadership team has suspended and kicked out high-ranking members who ask questions about the State Board of Elections investigation or the group's financial records, quote, or anybody that doesn't just do what they say. The SCV's dissenters say they aren't looking to destroy the neo-Confederate group. They want to refocus it on a battle over historical memory that's existed since as early as 1866. But with about a dozen members cooperating with the ongoing investigation and any potential charges still pending, the group's uncertain future is uncertain. Still, Smith's outlook is bullish, he says. "We're in this to get rid of all the corrupt people and make it a good organization where people could join and be shown respect and ask what their opinions are on stuff. You don't know what else is coming either. There's a lot more coming." I'll just quickly mention a couple of, Indie Week housekeeping or corrections issues. Susan Harper, the publisher, has just announced that Jane Porter will be the next editor-in-chief. They've had a temporary for several months since the last one was asked to retire. And we'll hear more about Jane Porter in a little while. She used to be a contributor to the Indie Week. And although I did not read the full endorsements from many of these candidates last week's edition, I did. There was no time. There were two clarifications that the Indie Week has written by Lee Toss concerning the Republican Chris Dillon for the Court of Appeals judge, who said their characterization of him and his was a incorrect, and they gave him a little space to respond. And the other one's Terrence Priester campaign, which says that he never made a statement regarding the LGBTQ community as the Indie Week had stated. And they retract that in part, at least. It's the anti-LGBTQ statements as a pastor of the Our Beliefs page, where he's listed as the founder and senior pastor. And the rest of my time I'll spend on music and arts articles, and just to basically mention two reviews, one by Jordan Lawrence and one by Sarah Edwards. New albums by the Mountain Goats get a 4.5 stars from Jordan Lawrence. It's called Getting Into Knives. And Rachel Keel's album Dream Logic is given 4 stars by Sarah Edwards. All these articles can be perused on the IndieWeeks website for those people who wish. Then Michelle Dwyer writes about Wendy Spitzer, The Sound of Sorrow, on turning crowdsourced grief into site-specific songs. And that article is too long to read, as well as is Small Wonders, which asks the question, will Phase 3 leave behind music venues too tiny for social distancing? And there is a movie called The Planters, which was given as showing at the Carolina Theater now, that some theaters are open again. The Planters, called Buried Treasure, a character-driven, low-budget comedy gem, given 4 stars by Glenn McDonald. If you're looking to cheer yourself up in a big way, clear a night this week for The Planters, an uncommonly good indie comedy and a kind of minor miracle in this foul year of our Lord, 2020. Written and directed by lead actors Alexander Kostchev and Hannah Lader, rookie filmmakers with ridiculously bright futures, The Planters was filmed with no on-set crew. They handled everything themselves, from design and cinematography to costumes and makeup. They actually shot The Planters before the pandemic, but their radically do-it-yourself approach could easily be a blueprint for making a feature film in quarantine conditions. The story, somewhere in a small desert town of Central California, Martha Plant is barely getting by as a work-from-home telemarketer. Her parents recently passed away, decapitated in a car accident, as it happens, and she's desperately lonely. Kostchev and Lader here have created something special, a character-driven comedy with a tiny budget, a great script, and some lovely performances. Kostchev, as the tightly wound Martha, has the kind of precise comic timing you're either born with or not. She delivers whole jokes just using her eyes. Lader, meanwhile, develops distinct characters for her multiple personalities. Also, watch for interstitial Bible jokes in stop-motion animation. It's hard to explain. There's a good bit of Wes Anderson here, with a quiet wit and symmetrical visual compositions. Planters is available as an early release in the kind of virtual theatrical run via the Carolina Theater's website, I see. Well, here comes Deep Blue to tell me to, I have to hush up now. This broadcast of Indie Week will be available on ncreadingservice.org's website as a podcast very soon after its initial showing broadcast. So we thank you for joining us tonight, and we will see you, or we will encounter you, next week.